Welcome to Early Returns, hosted by Jan Baron, a partner of Holtzman Vogel. This podcast examines law and politics and seeks insights from political players in elections, lobbying, media, and the law. Now, let's join our host, Jan Baron.
Welcome back to Early Returns, a podcast about law and politics. I'm your host, Jan Baron. Our producer is Jody Mayer Piazza. Today, I want to discuss when law becomes political and when politics becomes legal. In our podcast, we try to examine how politics affects the legal process and how the legal system copes with politics and political issues. One of my guests last year on Early Returns was Politico's senior legal affairs reporter, Josh Gerstein. Josh is the reporter who broke the news about the draft Supreme Court opinion in the Dobbs abortion case, which overruled Roe versus Wade. When recently accepting one of several awards for his reporting, Josh made some comments that got my attention. Josh said, quote, "It now seems so many of the major policy decisions on abortion, health insurance, climate change, and guns are resolved in the courts and often at the Supreme Court. In fact," says Josh Gerstein, "it often seems like litigation has replaced legislation as the preferred means of advancing one's agenda in this country." Josh concluded by saying, "The media need to up its game in covering the third branch of government." End of quote. So is litigation replacing legislation? What would someone from the judiciary say about that? Well, I'm lucky to have as my guest today someone who left the third branch of government and might offer some perspective. Thomas Griffith was a judge for 15 years on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He retired in 2020. Many lawyers consider the D.C. Circuit Court the second most important court in the country after the Supreme Court. Prior to going on the appellate bench, Judge Griffith served as general counsel of Brigham Young University, and before that as general counsel of the United States Senate. Judge Griffith also worked several years in private practice, including at a D.C. law firm. And in the interest of full disclosure, I have to note that I had the privilege of being one of Judge Griffith's law partners at that time. Tom Griffith is a graduate of the University of Virginia Law School and a resident of Virginia. He now is with the law firm Hunton Andrews Kurth. Judge Griffith, welcome to Early Returns, and thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Jan. It's a pleasure to be here. Good to see you.
Good to see you and to hear you. Even though we were partners many years ago, it's been several years since we actually reconnected, and I'm glad that we did so, and particularly for the benefit of our audience. Now, I've given all the dramatic highlights of your illustrious career, but I thought there might be a few more things you could share with our audience about yourself. For example, where did you grow up and what made you decide to become a lawyer?
Sure. So both my wife and I are products of the public school system in Fairfax County, Virginia. I grew up in McLean, Virginia, but my roots go even deeper than that. On my mother's side of the family, the Bell family goes back to the area we now call Washington, D.C. and Montgomery County to 1650. Farmers, laborers, artisans, all of them. But that's on the Bell side, my mother's side of the family. My father's side of the family, Griffiths, go back to Washington, D.C. in the 1830s. So I'm a swamp creature, native Washingtonian. I went to public schools in Fairfax County, Virginia, and went to school with the sons and daughters of members of Congress, members of the Supreme Court. There's nothing particularly unusual about where we live. My father worked for the federal government. My mother sold real estate, but we just lived amongst and around all these really interesting people. In those days, congressmen and senators could afford to live in this area, and they did. And so I would say that my interest in the law started in early age just by being around my friends and getting to know their parents and seeing what they were doing. So I decided at a pretty early age that I would like to be somehow involved in the law, maybe the intersection of law and politics. I think the most formative influence on me came in my high school years, where I lived across the street from Morris K. Udall, Democratic congressman from Arizona. And he kind of took me under wing, and I worked for him in summers and We drove to work together each day, and I followed Mo Ute all around for several years, and he was a hero to me. As I got older, my political views diverged from his, but he was a powerful influence for good in my life, and he was a lawyer, so I wanted to become a lawyer.
That's very interesting. Mo Udall is somebody I've always admired. He was very prominent in Washington and American politics. He ran for president once and, of course, was reelected often from Arizona.
And 1976, he was a couple of primaries away from getting the Democratic nomination.
And he's also the one candidate I point to when talking about the phenomenon of losing candidates, never admitting that there was just a bona fide reason for their loss. They always tend to blame underhanded campaign techniques or money or this or that. But Mo Udall, when he lost the campaign, on his public statement, made the announcement that people have spoken, damn it. And it was the most honest speech from a losing candidate I've ever heard.
I think he, at least the way I heard the story, it's a little stronger than that. He called him an expletive. The line on him is he was too funny to be president, right?
Yep. Great. Well, you have an interest in law and politics. And of course, this podcast is about law and politics. And one of the things that I mentioned that you did in your career was to be general counsel of the Senate. And at that time, you witnessed perhaps the most dramatic intersection of law and politics, the constitutional dynamic of impeachment. And in this case, it was the impeachment trial in the Senate of President Bill Clinton. What was your role during that trial? And what was your impression of impeachments now, since we've had two more since the Bill Clinton impeachment?
Yeah, it used to be that it was something unusual and unique to be involved in an impeachment proceeding, and less so today. But so the position I held was, the title of it was Senate Legal Counsel, and it was a nonpartisan position. It was created by statute, the last of the Watergate reforms. The Senate wanted to have its own lawyer instead of relying on Justice Department lawyers or private counsel. And so the office was created in 1978, 1979, and I was the second Senate legal counsel. And I stressed that it was nonpartisan. Even though the prime mover in my hire was Senator Bob Dole, the statute required that in the performance of my duties, I'd be nonpartisan, and Senator Dole fully expected that of me. And so the role that the office was able to play was a really unique one. We were at ground zero of the planning for and the carrying out of the impeachment trial. And Senator Lott was the Republican leader, the majority leader at the time. Senator Daschle was the Democratic leader. And they both relied upon our office to give them advice about how to put on an impeachment trial. I mean, the mechanics of it, as well as some of the legal issues involved. So I have to take my hat off to both Senator Lott and Senator Daschle, who brought me right into the center. I mean, as a staffer, it was a dream come true. I mean, a staff, you always want to be helpful to principals. And they brought us in, me and my deputy, into this, the early stages. And so we were able to help both Senator Lott and Senator Daschle think through the process, the mechanics, identify what the issues would be and how best to have those issues presented to the Senate. So I jokingly say, if you like the way the Senate went about its impeachment trial of President Clinton, give us some credit. You know, if you don't like the way it went about, give us some blame, because our fingerprints were all over it. But it was an extraordinary experience. Now, there was very little thought that President Clinton was actually going to be removed from office. You know, in the early days, there was some concern among some senators that that might happen. But the general sense was that that was not likely to happen. But both Senator Lott and Senator Daschle cared a great deal about how the Senate was perceived in this. And so much of our thinking, much of our discussion was along the lines of what can we do to preserve and enhance the role of the Senate as an institution in this, so that due process is had. You know, I can't tell you the number of times when I heard the leaders say, we're talking about the President of the United States and the office of the presidency, and we are going to show the office of the presidency the respect the office deserves, even if individual senators thought that maybe the occupant of that office hadn't shown great respect for the office because of his conduct. the Senate was dedicated to the idea it was going to show that office respect. So
a Senate trial is really a rare confluence of all three branches of government. I mean, the Senate is conducting the trial, the Chief Justice presides over the trial, and the target of the trial is the Chief Executive. What was the dynamic between the Senate and the Senate leadership that you mentioned and the Chief Justice at that time, William Rehnquist?
Yeah, it was, well, first of all, the discussions were extensive, and we took the Senate leadership over to the Supreme Court to have a morning full of discussions with the Chief Justice. It was a little bit unusual in the fact that Chief Justice Rehnquist was a bit of an amateur historian and had written a book on the history of presidential impeachments in the Senate called Grand Inquest. So that was a little bit unusual. He was fairly knowledgeable about the history of impeachment proceedings, and that made it all the more interesting. He had pronounced views about how he thought the proceeding ought to take place. Of course, when the Chief Justice presides over a presidential impeachment, he does so as the presiding officer of the Senate. And so there were some interesting negotiations and discussions to make certain that the Chief Justice understood that the Senate leadership, that this was in the Senate, that this is a Senate function. And he did. He got that. But he got that as a result of a number of discussions that were had.
So that's another archaic instance where the branches of government intersect because the vice president of the United States is the president of the Senate as a representative of the executive branch. So that dynamic has to be worked out in at least those two instances.
No, it was. And there were extensive discussions and interesting discussions. Actually, Peter Baker, in his book on the impeachment trial of President Clinton called The Breach, does a great job of covering all this. And there were actually some fairly interesting moments when it became clear to Chief Justice Rehnquist that this was a Senate proceeding and that Senator Lott and Senator Daschle were sort of running the show, and that his job was as presiding officer of the Senate was a little bit different than would be his job as Chief Justice of the United States. So.
And as I mentioned, there have been obviously two more impeachment trials, both of them against former President Trump. I assume you observed what transpired in those two instances. Do you have any observation of how they were similar to what you witnessed back in 1998 when the Clinton trial?
I do. I mean, they were very different in some ways. The allegations were different. But I think the learning that comes out of these three experiences is that an impeachment of the President of the United States, even though it's permissible to impeach a president on a straight majority vote in the House of Representatives, that's not going to lead to removal from office. It needs to be something, you know, Nixon-esque, where there is a supermajority. Obviously, under the rule of the Constitution, there has to be a supermajority to remove a president after the trial in the Senate. I think some of the learning is, unless you have that in the House, maybe it's not a productive effort. And that it seems like it just becomes a political game, using the impeachment process to score political points, which I think most folks would agree that's probably not a wise use of the process, even though the framers and, you know, Hamilton and the Federalist Papers recognize that it's a political process. It's not a criminal process. I don't think the intention was ever that it become a partisan process. And so I think that's the, and saying that, I'm not making any judgment about the strength or weakness of the allegations. I just think that we've learned from the three recent experiences that unless there's a supermajority in the House, it's not going to lead to removal. And then therefore, what point is it in having it? So I think that's the big lesson.
Well, the impeachment as a process, clearly, it's a constitutional process. I think it would be fair to say that at least with respect to all three recent instances, whether it was President Clinton or President Trump twice, it resembled a political process as intended by the framers. And it was used mostly for political objectives, even when the majority recognized or thought that it was unlikely to lead to an actual conviction and removal from office. So it may be a sign of how politics has intervened in utilizing some of these constitutional legal processes. And I think the same thing could be said with respect to the judicial confirmation process, which has become extremely contentious.
Can I add one more word about impeachment? What you said struck me something. There's something very unique about the impeachment process in the Senate, and that is that no senator can participate in the impeachment trial unless he or she has taken a separate oath, an oath separate and apart from their oath of office. And in that oath, they pledge that they will do impartial justice. And so that's an attempt to make it not partisan. I'll let the historians and the philosophers decide whether that has any purchase at all. But I do think it speaks to a norm that I've referring to before, that it really ought to be something beyond partisan gamesmanship. And so I guess that's a call from this quarter, at least, to think this through a little more carefully.
Yeah, well, I have to say that it's nice to hear that they have to take a separate oath. It suspends belief that they actually don't have strong views, mostly driven by politics and perhaps even by personal animus or favoritism. But what has happened in the impeachment process to me, and this is just my view, is that it's become a substitute for campaign ads, you know, in the off season. Well, you know, we want to fill the air with a lot of recriminations and be on nightly cable news for several weeks. Why don't we impeach a president? That'll get us the exposure for our political objectives that we otherwise would have to spend a lot of privately raised money in order to accomplish in campaign advertising. So I'm really struck by the denigration of what should have been a very rare, very serious process with serious claims. I think we can say that that was true of the Nixon experience, even though technically he was never impeached by the House because he resigned before the impeachment. But the committee passed articles of impeachment, and he would have been impeached. It was clear, which is one reason he resigned. But both the Clinton and the Trump episodes really sort of diminish the meaningfulness of the impeachment process. Now, I don't want to make a straight comparison between impeachment and judicial confirmation. There are major differences. Of course, judges have to be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. But we all know that that has become a very contentious process in and of itself, perhaps starting, as many people think, with the unsuccessful confirmation consideration for the Supreme Court of Judge Robert Bork, who at the time sat on the court that sat on for 15 years. And you yourself have gone through a confirmation process, and you've seen many of your judicial colleagues go through that. And since your retirement from the court, you've been active in confirmation processes for at least two judges to the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett and Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Having gone through the process, you know, what was that like for you? And what has changed about confirmation? What is the significance of the way nominees like you and your colleagues have to go through this Senate grueling process? How does that affect your judging?
There's a lot in there. They're good questions. Let me try and unpack them. Let's talk about me. For me, my process was relatively tame. I attribute that to two things. One, I had worked at the highest levels in the Senate and had the strong support of the Democratic and Republican leadership. So that made my process a lot tamer than most would be. And also, I was nominated during a time when there was the Senate filibuster existed for judicial nominations. In fact, I'm an argument for or against the filibuster. I'm the result of what you get when you really want Miguel Estrada and he gets filibustered and you don't get him. So what do you do then? I literally replaced Miguel Estrada in the president's nomination queue. And so again, you can make up your own arguments whether that's a filibuster is a good thing or not. But
yeah. What was the vote on your nomination in the Senate?
It was 73-25 or something like that. It was supposed to be much higher than that, but I ran into a little speed bump with Senator Leahy. He was upset at Senator Hatch over something and took it out on me, but I didn't take it personally. That's the Senate leadership, the Democratic Senate leadership said, don't take it personally. You're going to be confirmed. So there wasn't as much drama for mine. So I came out of that process. I think the process is at the Supreme Court level is just intolerable. It's an awful process that we go through, that they go through right now. And when I introduced Judge Jackson to the Senate Judiciary Committee, I made that point. The White House asked me to introduce her. She asked me to introduce her. The White House asked me to introduce her. They approved my remarks. And I was critical of both Democrats and Republicans for the way the process has devolved. Antonin Scalia approved 98-0. His acolyte, Amy Coney Barrett, doesn't get a single vote from across the aisle. Obviously, something's changed. And the question is that for the better or for the worse? And I think it's decidedly for the worse. I favor a return to what I call regular order. That is, presidents get their judges. A president wins an election, he or she gets the judges they want. Now, obviously, there's got to be some minimal level of competency and honesty. And is there any serious question that Amy Coney Barrett and Ketanji Brown Jackson weren't competent? No. They have different approaches to the law. That's fine. Elections have consequences. So I think we're in a really bad state of the confirmation process. You asked, does it affect a judge's decision making? And I just have to tell you, from what I've seen, no. At least I can only report firsthand evidence from the DC Circuit. In 15 years on the DC Circuit, I never saw any of my colleagues cast a vote that was somehow driven by their prior partisan affiliation. You don't think that way as a judge. You get on the court and you're trying to figure out facts and law, not policy. You leave that to the legislature, to the elected folks. So no, I didn't see that on the DC Circuit. I saw just the opposite of that. I saw people wrestling to figure out what the law requires, not what their personal policy preferences are. But here's the problem, Jan, as I see it. When you watch the confirmation hearings, particularly the Supreme Court, you hear many questions from both sides of the aisle that assume that the judge will be a partisan in robes. That's the phrase Justice Breyer would often use, saying we are not partisans in robes. And yet much of the questioning assumes that, much of the media coverage assumes that. And so therefore, it's not surprising that many of the American people believe that a federal judge is just a partisan in a robe. And I'm just here to tell you that in 15 years on the DC Circuit, I didn't see that happening.
Well, you just commented a little while ago that now Justice Coney Barrett and Justice Brown Jackson are very qualified judges, but they did have different views of the law. So a lot of the fighting that goes on may be couched in terms not of partisanship, but of judicial philosophies. And clearly there seem to be differences of opinion, certainly at the lower courts, and that gets heightened at the Supreme Court because that's the last court of the land that decides everything. And I'm wondering, in light of the comments that I recited in introducing you from Josh Gerstein, litigation, in his opinion, seems to be replacing legislation, that some part of this contentious confirmation process and the focus on judges is a reflection that many people in the Senate and certainly in politics think that Congress is incapable of legislating in certain areas because of differences or because they're limited in what they can do constitutionally, and that these types of decisions will be decided ultimately in the courts and particularly the Supreme Court. Do you think that has some validity?
I think it does, and I think it's unfortunate. I think it's a mistake. I mean, I'm a big fan of Yale Law School professor Akhil Amar, who is a political progressive and yet is an originalist, which one typically associates with conservative politicians, but that shows that that's not always a fair description. But Professor Amar makes the point, and I think it's a profound one, that the most fundamental liberty protected in the Constitution of the United States is the liberty of we the people, through their elected representatives, to make the rules, to make the laws. And I agree with that. That's the great innovation of the American Constitution. It's that we the people, through the elected representatives, are going to make law. It's not going to be kings. It's not going to be priests. It's not going to be popes. It's not going to be mullahs or rabbis. It's going to be we the people through the elected representatives. And it's not going to be judges, right? I mean, as a judge, I'm not politically accountable in the sense of I don't stand for election or re-election. We try and insulate our judges from that political dynamic. In our system, we don't want judges to legislate. We want politically accountable representatives to do so. So if they do something we don't like, we can throw them out of office. Judges aren't supposed to be in that field at all. They're supposed to take the law that's been enacted by the politically accountable representatives and apply it to disputes before them. That's the ideal, right? And I'm in favor of doing everything we can to reach, to aspire to that ideal and not to throw it overboard. Now, the problem, as you've identified, is in many areas, Congress hasn't legislated, or they legislate in very vague terms, right? And courts have to figure out, what are they saying here? And that's where you run into judges having different philosophies about how to approach what Congress has done. I mean, you have some judges who call themselves textualists, and they're just going to look at the words that Congress passed, and they're going to apply those. And the most famous recent example of that is the Bostock case that says that on its own terms, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act applies to forbid discrimination against sexual orientation. And that's a conservative justice, Justice Gorsuch, who wrote that. Another school of thought is, no, you can't just look at the words. You have to try and figure out the purpose. What was Congress trying to do? That may lead you to different results. It's those who oppose Justice Gorsuch's view would say, if you look at the purpose of Title VII, no one had in mind sexual orientation at that time. So there you have somebody who's different approaches to how to read and apply a statute. And those different approaches don't always map neatly with progressive and conservative, which I think the best explanation for decisions like that is you have judges with different views about how to understand what Congress has done. Those are big issues. Those are very different views about how to read an act of Congress, and they lead to very different results.
What do you think of the recent instances where prominent political figures very publicly criticize a decision made by the Supreme Court? And I'm thinking of two instances. One was President Obama in the State of the Union speech chastised the Supreme Court, most of whose members were sitting right in front of the podium, for the outcome in their decision in the Citizens United case. And then separately, and at a different time, Senator Schumer, a Democrat, standing in front of the Supreme Court, making ominous warnings to the justices by name regarding their upcoming decision on abortion. What is the effect of that type of public criticism by people who nominate and confirm judges?
First of all, I mean, I think when you're in the public sphere, we're Americans, we disagree over things, right? And so I think any judge or justice expects that when they make a decision, it's going to be subject to criticism. That's fine. I don't have any problem with that. Now, it's the nature of the criticism that I think makes a big difference. And if the criticism is suggesting or implying that the judge or justice has made that decision based on his or her partisan preferences, that's a serious criticism. Because what that's saying is you, judge or justice, have violated your oath of office, right? Your oath of office is that you'll be impartial, that you'll be neutral in this, but you have violated that. That's a serious, serious allegation. And it undermines public confidence in the role of the judiciary. And as I already told you, what I have seen is I'm with John, Chief Justice, on this. Remember when President Trump criticized a decision of a district court judge in Illinois. President Trump dismissed it as, oh, he's an Obama judge. And in something remarkable, I think it was either later that day or the next day, the Chief Justice issued a public rebuke of the President of the United States and said, we don't have Obama judges. We don't have Clinton judges. We have judges who are trying their best to apply the law. Now, I know the Chief Justice came in some criticism for that, people saying, oh, how naive can one be? Well, count me naive, because I'm telling you, I've been in the room where it happens, okay? I've been at least on the D.C. Circuit, and I'm telling you, the judges that I worked with on the D.C. Circuit were doing law. They weren't doing politics. Justice Breyer, Stephen Breyer, says the same thing about his experience on the Supreme Court. We're doing law. We're not doing politics. The best response I've seen to this criticism that judges are partisans in robes comes from Justice Barrett in responding to this idea that we're just partisan hacks. Her response, I thought, was a forceful one, saying, read our opinions. Don't read what folks on cable are telling you about our opinions. Don't read what the Wall Street Journal and New York Times tell us. read our opinions. Now, that's a challenge because we're all busy people and they're long opinions, but I think she's on to something. You read those opinions and they are thoughtful, careful, well-reasoned. They disagree about law. It's not being driven by politics. I wish that, you know, we could bring the American people with us behind the curtains to see how this thing works. It isn't perfect. Judges make mistakes. Some give into the temptation to allow their personal preferences to, but that's rare. And I'm telling you, I didn't see it. What I saw was judges struggling with understanding what the law is and arguments over law, not over politics, not over policy. Now, whenever I say, and I say this everywhere I go, and I give a lot of speeches on law school campuses, I'm met with this incredulous response, right? Like, oh, that can't possibly be the case. How do you explain the 5-4 votes and things of that nature? And my response to that is they're struggling with law and how to interpret law. They're not up there rooting for Democrats or Republicans. That's just not what I've seen from my experience. That's not what I see when I look carefully at the Supreme Court. So therefore, the criticisms that suggest that that's what's going on, that they are just partisan in robes, I think they're not well-founded, and I think they're dangerous. I think they work to undermine the public's perception of the role of the courts, and that's playing with fire. For many years, I've been involved in rule of law programs in former communist countries of the Soviet Union. And as I travel throughout the region and meet with reformers, to a person, what they admire most about the American government is our independent judiciary. That's what they aspire to because they don't have it under totalitarian rule. And I think it's the crown jewel of our democracy. I think it's critical that we preserve the public, we create and preserve the public perception of that which is true. And that is judges, federal judges are dealing with law. They're not partisans in robes. That's a long answer to saying criticism's fine, but the type of criticism that you hear leveled from many sources is inaccurate and it's really dangerous.
I think that the criticism is a reflection of political forces and public expectations of the judiciary, and particularly at a time when both our politics and society in general are so divided over some fundamental issues that don't seem to be resolved either locally or through other political means. And all of a sudden, these issues present themselves to the courts. And now we have an expectation, well, the court's going to decide this political issue. And I think it's political, say the observers, even though you judges don't think you're making a decision on a political basis, but you know that we think it's a political issue that needs to be resolved.
It has political consequences, no question about it. And I think the judiciary needs to do a better job of explaining how it goes about making its decisions. Because I think if people were to see how it actually works, I think they would be encouraged and much more optimistic than seems to be the trend these days. So,
well, sometimes there are overreactions to the point that people are so dissatisfied with a judicial outcome that they actually want to change the process. And that was something that came up after the decision, which overruled Roe versus Wade. President Biden created a commission to study what happens at the Supreme Court and whether, for example, the composition of the court should be changed in constitutionally or otherwise. And you were asked to participate as a member of that commission. What did that commission do? And what, if anything, did it recommend to President Biden?
Yeah. So I think the genesis of it actually comes back to the Democratic primaries, in that there were a number of President Biden's opponents who were recommending expanding the number of justices on the court. And as I recall, I think it was in the general election campaign, I think it was a 60 Minutes interview where he was asked, are you in favor of court packing? And he responded that if he were elected, he was going to form a bipartisan commission to study the history of the Supreme Court and the debate, the general debate surrounding the role of the court. And lo and behold, he did that. And I was one of 5 or 6 folks who made it bipartisan, although I'm no longer affiliated with any party. I'm no longer a Republican. I am a political conservative. So I told them that. I said, look, I'm not a Republican. I call myself a post-partisan political conservative. And they said, that's good enough.
When did you declare you were an independent, not a Republican?
As soon as I became a judge. When I became a judge, I no longer voted in primaries and tried to stop thinking along partisan lines. When I left the bench, I just kept that view. I do consider myself a political conservative, but I'm not. I don't do partisan politics anymore. That's another topic that I'd love to speak about, but maybe that's not. But so anyway, so I was placed on this commission, and we were told at the outset by the White House that what they wanted was a thorough study of the debate, the history of the debate over the role of the Supreme Court in American government. I'm going back to the 19th century or so. So many of the members of our commission were academics, a lot of legal historians. We were told at the outset there was one thing we were not going to be asked to do, and that was to make recommendations, that we weren't going to be recommending things. We were just going to be describing the nature of the debate, and the president could do with it what he wanted. I have to tell you, it was a great experience, and I give a lot of credit to that, to the co-chairs of our committee, Bob Bauer and Christina Rodriguez. They just made it clear that we're going to listen to everybody. We're going to take lots of testimony. We're going to hear from all quarters. We're going to do our homework. We're going to spend a lot of time digging into this. And we did. And we came up with a report. I don't imagine anyone's going to give it to someone for a birthday present or an anniversary present, but you should. It's really a good report and gives a great explanation of the history of the debate and then the arguments itself on a number of issues, court expansion being one of them, other debates over whether there should be lifetime appointment as the Constitution requires, or should the Constitution be amended to require something else. Those were the two issues I think that got the most interest in the public. But we were not asked to make recommendations, so we didn't. But I will say this, as one of the conservatives on there, our views were heard and are expressed in the report. So I think the report gives if someone wants to go to one source to sort of come up to speed on the nature of the debate over these issues, our report, I think, does a really good job. We gave it to the president, had a wonderful meeting with the president where he accepted the report, and it was actually pretty inspiring in terms of the comments he made about the Constitution and its role. So I think it was a great experience. But, you know, those sorts of things don't get a lot of press these days, when the idea that liberals and conservatives could get together and agree unanimously, it was consensus report. That doesn't seem to make a lot of news, but I thought it was pretty newsworthy that happened in this environment.
Well, it sounds newsworthy to a point, since you didn't have to agree on a specific recommendation. So, and acknowledging that.
I tell you, there were some members of the commission who were very much in favor of court expansion. They didn't do a straw poll or anything, but my sense was that if we had taken a vote, and I'm speculating here, so maybe I shouldn't, but my sense was if we had been asked to make a recommendation, I don't think court expansion would carry a majority of the members of the commission. It's a really bad idea. It's just an awful idea. And I don't think there's anything that President Biden has ever said as Senator Biden that would suggest that he would think it was a good idea. But again, I shouldn't speak for him in that regard. But I didn't get the sense that there were, five or six of us opposing court expansion and the barbarians were at the gate. It wasn't anything like that. I got the sense that there were a few commissioners and not that many who would be in favor of court expansion.
You know, one of the most significant historic developments of the American judicial system, in my view, is the consequence of the Dred Scott decision, which, of course, some would say led to the Civil War itself. But in terms of judicial development, the Dred Scott decision by the U.S. Supreme Court came down at a time when the country was expanding, adding many states and growing from coast to coast. And to this day, only 11 states in their state judiciary have some form of an appointed judiciary. And the other 39 states pretty much require all judges to be elected. And that is a response to the Dred Scott decision, where the new Americans who are forming new states concluded, we don't want a unresponsive lifetime court of judges making what we consider to be a very boneheaded decision. Now, I think it's a miracle that the federal judiciary has survived that type of turmoil and continues to have lifetime appointments without any elections. And it's probably a very good thing, because it provides continuity and stability to the federal judicial system. And it would also require a constitutional change to do away with that. But as we look at what's going on today, which is a very rough time and a lot of controversy, it doesn't compare to the upheaval that occurred in the mid-19th century, both in terms of the role of the courts, as well as what political division can result in. Even though I know there are some historians today who are saying we, you know, democracy is at stake and we might be headed into some modern version of a civil war, I don't think it compares to what was going on back then.
It may not, but that's a great example, though, of what I would say. Here was a court, the Dred Scott Court, stepping outside its lane, taking on a role that was inappropriate for judges to take. And the reaction was a disastrous one. I mean, I'm with Justice O'Connor on this one. She's not well now, but when she was still vigorous, one of her big projects was to do away with elections of state judges. I think that's an awful idea. If in fact it was a reaction to Dred Scott, and I don't doubt that it was, I hadn't quite thought of it that way, but let's imagine that that's completely right. That's an example of how the judiciary needs to be very careful to not step outside its lane, because it could lead to what I could consider to be disastrous consequences. Can I offer a story that came from my time on the President's Commission on the Supreme Court? It came from a dear friend of mine who's since passed away, Walter Dellinger. Walter Dellinger was an acting Solicitor General of the United States in the Obama or in the Clinton administration. You know, longtime Democratic lawyer. You've probably had lots of experience with Walter. He and I always got along well. He told the following story at one of our public meetings of the commission about how important it is to maintain the independence of the judiciary, to make certain that judges stay in their lane and don't act like politicians in robes. He was the lawyer for the United States who argued before the Supreme Court in the case that was called Clinton versus Jones. And that was whether President Clinton, while in office, needed to participate in a civil lawsuit against him. And Walter Dellinger, arguing for the government, said, no, that would be too burdensome on him. He ought to be protected until he leaves office. Well, Walter lost that case 9-0, which brings to mind, Chief Justice Roberts would tell the story about when he lost a case 9-0 and told the client, I lost 9-0. And the client said, 9-0? How did you lose 9-0? And Chief Justice said, there were only 9 justices on the Supreme Court, right? So Walter Dellinger loses this case 9-0. He learns about the loss when he's giving a lecture to law students in Beijing, okay, in Beijing. And while he's there, the news breaks that the President of the United States has lost a case in front of the United States Supreme Court 9-0. Walter said it was one of the most inspiring moments of his life, as he saw these Chinese students who were absolutely incredulous that such a thing could happen. How can the President of the United States lose 9-0? Well, that's how the rule of law works. Now, I'm not naive. Federal judiciary is not perfect, but it gets it right a lot of times. And I don't want to give up on that aspiration of preserving the rule of law. And I think that plans such as the court packing plans, they give up on that. They give up on the ideal. They say, no, it can never be achieved. And so let's give up on it. And I disagree. I think it can be achieved. I think it is achieved much of the time. And we ought to work to get it achieved all of the time.
That's a great story. And I did know Walter Dellinger, not well, but obviously I've had cases in which he made an appearance for the government and other parties. And I always thought it was a privilege to encounter great lawyers like that in law practice. It does also, your story reminds me of a similar episode that I experienced with a former client, fellow by the name of Arlen Specter, who was a senator from Pennsylvania. He also has passed away, and he would not only be an occasional client, but he would call on me oftentimes when there was legislation involving campaign finance and other issues at the Senate. And of course, he was a very good lawyer. He was a graduate of the Yale Law School and was a member of their moot court board. His photo is displayed in the moot courtroom at Yale Law School with his colleagues from law school. And we had some conversation where we had a difference of opinion about what the Supreme Court might think of a piece of legislation that was coming up in the Senate. And he kind of interrupted my version of the story by saying, well, you know, I, I've argued a case at the Supreme Court. And I said, well, yes, Senator, I think I remember that. Wasn't that the challenge to the closing of the naval base in Philadelphia? You brought that case and you actually argued that case before the Supreme Court. And he said, yes, I did. And I did lose that case. And I said, well, Senator, I recall you lost that case 9-0. He chuckled a little bit. He doesn't like to be reminded of a 9-0 loss, but that happens. And that's yet another example of how the judicial system might work. Here you have a senator arguing a case before the Supreme Court. And of course, he was a longtime member of the Judiciary Committee and certainly presided over several of the confirmations of the judges before whom he was arguing. Now, we've talked about a lot of these political issues and the intersection and the state of the judiciary as well as the state of our country, and which is, as I mentioned, deeply and narrowly divided over many, many issues. You yourself publicly have described the situation as toxic polarization because people's difference of opinion and strong feelings are really creating an unpleasant political environment, unpleasant social environment. We seem to be a country where oftentimes people with different opinions can't even talk to each other. I know this is a subject that you care about greatly. What do you think can be done to improve the civic and political debate and the lack of tempered disagreement? I mean, what can we do about this?
Yeah, so the problem isn't that we disagree. Again, we're Americans. This is democracy. We better disagree, right? It's the way we disagree. And the fact that social scientists tell us that actually things are almost as bad as they were in the 1850s, that there is this something called affective polarization, where your hatred for the other side is greater than your commitment to your own side. And what this means is that in many instances, contempt has replaced disagreement. And it just skews the whole system. Jonathan Haidt, the social psychologist at NYU who wrote The Righteous Mind and other great works, said in an interview a couple of years ago, he predicted, and he's not a Chicken Little sort of guy, right? He's not somebody who runs onto cable news all the time and predicts the end of the world. But he did say this, he predicted a catastrophic failure of American democracy because, he said, we just don't know what happens to a democracy when you drain all trust out of the system. Well, I don't want to ever be heard disagreeing with Jonathan Haidt. He's much smarter than I am. But I think we do know what happens when you drain all trust out of the system. You get things like January 6th, right? When people think the system is rigged against them and that elections are stolen, that's the type of reaction they have. So what do we do about it? I think there are two things that we do. First of all, we push back against this noxious false story that the 2020 election was somehow stolen and not lost. There is no credible evidence for that. It has been investigated every which way. And the only people who are claiming that it was stolen and not lost, I'm sorry, they just don't have any real basis for this. And so yet today, 60 to 70% of Republicans tell pollsters they think the election was fraudulent. Well, that's just not true. The election was lost and it wasn't stolen. That I'm speaking to the grand master here, but in the last year and a half or so, along with two other former federal judges appointed by Republican presidents, Michael McConnell, who's now at Stanford Law School, and Michael Luden, who was on the Fourth Circuit. The two of us put together a report using folks like Ben Ginsburg, Ted Olson, Senator Danforth, Senator Smith, David Hoppe, other known conservatives, put together a report doing a deep dive into each of the contested states in 2020. And we came up with the only conclusion that you can when you look at the evidence, and that is the election was lost. It wasn't stolen. So we wrote this report for fellow conservatives trying to tell them, no, that's not the right argument to make. If you want to win in the future, you can't be making the argument that the election was stolen. In that process, I'm new to this area. You're the expert. I learned about our election administration system in the country. It needs improvement. There's no question about it, but it's pretty darn good. The stories that I grew up with of ballot boxes being stuffed in Philadelphia and dead people voting in Chicago, unfortunately, those stories were true. It doesn't happen anymore. It's certainly not at that level. And there wasn't a single precinct in 2020 where the outcome would have been changed because of fraud. Not one. That story needs to get out there. Our political leaders need to tell the American public that our election administration system works really well. Can it improve? Absolutely. But it works really, really well. It's been professionalized. It's transparent. It's a great system. So anyone who's out there saying the election was stolen is doing a great disservice to our country because they are undermining trust and confidence in our democracy. And as Jonathan Haidt says, that is going to lead to catastrophic failure. So that's the first thing we do is push back on that story. Get the facts. Be willing to tell your aunt at Thanksgiving dinner and your next door neighbor that's not the case. Let's run a campaign on issues, not falsehoods. So that's the easy thing to do. The tougher thing to do is to change the nature of our discourse. How do you get away from viewing others contemptuously? So there are two things I'll mention in that regard. First of all, if someone is getting most of their information about the world from cable, talk radio, and social media, that's a problem. You're being played in each of those. Each of those are part of what Arthur Brooks calls the outrage industrial complex. They're conflict entrepreneurs. I love that phrase. We're making money off the claim that there's breaking news every 10 minutes. There is not breaking news every 10 minutes, except on cable. And the reason it's there is because they figured out that's the way to get people to watch. That's the way to increase revenue dollars. So realize that if you go to cable, you go to talk radio, you go to social media, you're being played. Okay. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there are really good things happening. Over 90% of the American people, when polled, social scientists tell us over 90% of the American people are really dissatisfied with this toxic polarization, but they don't know what to do about it. And so that's a problem in search of a solution. Well, I think there are some solutions out there. I'll just mention one outfit called Braver Angels, run by David Blankenhorn. And this is one of many outfits that are trying to breach the toxic divide. And here's how they do it. They have these events all around the country, university campuses elsewhere, where I'll simplify it, where they bring MAGA supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters in the same room to discuss or debate a topic. And yet they've learned from the social science that there are ways that you can go about this that aren't filled with contempt. So they have these ground rules and they teach people how to have these discussions. And what they've learned is that people don't change their minds about the issues, but they do change their minds about the other person. That they realize that that other person is every bit as patriotic as you are, loves their family and children and puppy dogs, everybody as much as you do. They're not evil. They're not immoral. But right now, the social science data shows us that a majority of Republicans believe that a majority of Democrats are evil and immoral and vice versa. And that's what will cause the distrust that will bring the system down. We have to go back to Lincoln and the first inaugural uttering words that are part of our American canon, right? We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection, right? Well, it's beautiful words, went unheeded, and we're living with the consequences of it to this day, right? So the key has got to be that we have to do something to strengthen those bonds of affection. There's lots going on at the local level, not too much at the national level. So my encouragement to all of us is to find out who in your community is working on overcoming this polarization. I mentioned one out, Braver Angels. There's another one. Tim Shriver, who heads the Special Olympics, has started an organization called Unite. Same idea, bipartisan, Democrats, Republicans, progressives, conservatives, trying to figure out ways to get the contempt out of it. That's the key, the contempt out of it. If we can see that our opponents are just our opponents, then they're not our enemies. This comes a little easier to me than maybe not than others, but it comes easier to me because I used to be a Democrat. I worked for Mo Udall, right? I envisioned that my life was going to be a progressive Democrat. And then jokingly, this is a joke, I learned how to read. That's a joke, my progressive friends. But no, my life experience, my reading led me in a different direction. I came up with a different view. I thought that political conservatism is the best way to create a flourishing society, an opportunity society. I'm a Jack Kemp guy. You know, I'm a compassionate conservative type. So I just had different views. But I was never able to think that my mentor, Mo Udall, who ended up having very different views about how to create a just society than I did, I could never come to the viewpoint that he was evil or that he wasn't patriotic. No, he just had different views than I do. His may be right, mine may be wrong. I don't think so. I think he's wrong, I'm right. But I could just never muster the passion to think that a Democrat who just had different views than I do about these things is wicked or is evil. But unfortunately, we're in a place where, for whatever reasons, and there are many, too many people feel that way about folks who have different views. And that's what we got to take out of the system. So it starts, you know, this is going to sound like a Sunday school lesson, but I think it's true. It starts with us. It starts with us. How do we deal with these issues? But I'll finish with this. The best statement, I think, the best statement of this about what the Constitution requires, and I think it does require compromise. Yuval Levin has written a great piece in the National Review a couple months ago about national unity in the Constitution. And Yuval points out that the American system of government, the Constitution, requires compromise. You can't get it done without compromise. And out of that, Yuval points out, we learn something about how to get along with other people. But the best statement of this came from a former justice of the Utah Supreme Court, who also happens to be one of the leaders of my faith. I'm a Latter-day Saint. He gave a speech a couple of years ago about this toxic polarization and what the Constitution requires. And he came up with this phrase. I love it. He said, on contested issues, we should seek to moderate and to unify. And I think that's a pretty good template for what the Constitution requires. We take oaths to support and defend the Constitution. And that means a whole lot more than protecting your individual rights. Protecting, supporting, and defending the Constitution means more than religious liberty, although I'm a big proponent of religious liberty. It means more than the Second Amendment, although look at my opinions. I was the poster judge for the NRA for a while because of my opinions on the Second Amendment. But the Constitution's allowed a lot more than that. It's about more than equal protection, although I cast the vote in the Shelby County case that the Supreme Court overturned, I think wrongly. So I'll match my commitment to equal protection with anyone. But the Constitution is about so much more than the rights that are protected. It's about a system of government that requires compromise. It requires accommodation. It requires, on contested issues, we should seek to moderate and to unify. If you go back to the Philadelphia Convention in 1787 and see how were they able to pull it off? We know in July, the project was about to fail. Some delegates were packing their bags, ready to leave Philadelphia. And yet, since September, Washington is able to transmit the Constitution to the Continental Congress. In the letter transmitting it, this is what George Washington said. He said, and I'm going to get it pretty close. It's not going to be exact, but close enough. George Washington wrote to the Congress and said, this Constitution is the product of that spirit of amity, mutual deference, and concessions which the peculiarity of our political circumstance rendered indispensable. Washington thought amity, friendship and love, right? Deference and concession was necessary to create the Constitution. I agree with him. And I would argue that if you want to support the Constitution, that it requires amity, mutual deference and concession. And if you're not willing to do that, in your headlong pursuit of defending your Second Amendment rights or your headlong pursuit of defending religious liberty, if you're not willing to have the spirit of amity, to defer and to concede some things, you're the problem. You're not supporting and defending the Constitution. To support, Michael Gerson wrote famously, the American heroes are heroes of unity. So that's the spirit of the Constitution. So yes, I personally, I think this is an existential crisis we're facing. I worry. I think Jonathan Haidt might be right. I think we are facing a catastrophic failure because of this toxic polarization. What's the way out of it? Individually, we've got to change ourselves. And then I think we need to work for, you know, Tocqueville talked about these little platoons, right? These platoons out there that are working at overcoming toxic polarization. And it's being done. It's being done in some places. I live in Loudoun County, Virginia, just up the road from you. That's ground zero in the culture war over public education. And yet even in Loudoun County, we've seen some remarkable instances of citizens, just citizens tired of their school board meetings looking like a war zone, getting together groups from the LGBTQ community, from the religious right, getting them together to sit down and discuss these issues. And it's really been very, very encouraging to see what good can come of it. So it's hard work. It's got to be done on a local level, but I think it's every bit as important to preserving the Constitution as the Minutemen were to creating a country that created the Constitution.
Well, as you probably know, I'm pretty much an optimist in all this. My family, unlike yours, was not here in this country in the 17th or 18th century. We came when I was 3 years old, so I'm an immigrant, and we experienced great opportunities and great challenges as an immigrant family, and great success in having established ourselves here and witnessing both the dynamics of American society, American politics, American education. And I think this is all resolvable. It's very contentious. There's no question about it. It's unpleasant to see the name calling and the invective that accompanies so much of our debate. But I think that it's going to get resolved in part because of the groups of the sort that are forming that you've referenced. I think also there's going to have to be leadership from our political representatives in leading the way on a lot of this. I would note that Washington's words in transmitting the Constitution are very valid today, but I would also note historically that they were able to arrive at concessions when everything else didn't work. The Confederation of States and the Articles of Confederation, having 13 separate colonies with their own trade rules and their own constitutions, their own parliaments, not agreeing on anything that unified them as a nation, made concession necessary.
And they made some awful concessions. I mean, I'm not here to defend the particular compromise they came up with, but I'm relying now on a young scholar named Derek Webb, who wrote an article in the South Carolina Law Review a couple years ago with a great title. It's called "The Original Meaning of Civility, : Democratic Deliberation at the Philadelphia Convention." It's a great article. And his takeaway is that what made it succeed was, as you pointed out, no other options left, but a group of moderates got together and decided that they weren't going to let the convention fail. And so they persuaded others to compromise for the sake of unity, even before they knew the terms of the compromise. I mean, that was a risky move. That was a bold move. But I think our current circumstance requires that. There needs to be a willingness to compromise for the sake of unity. And that's really, really risky. But the risk is that if I am willing to accommodate you, that you're going to reciprocate to me. That's really risky, right? But that's what, according to Webb, that was the magic sauce that got it done in Philadelphia. I think maybe that's the magic sauce today. And if I can borrow a line from Hamilton, you're an immigrant, right? You're an immigrant family. And remember the line, immigrants, we get it done, from Hamilton. I would say moderates, we get it done. Folks who seek to moderate, I think that's what's called for.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Judge Griffith. We could go on so much longer because there are so many things to discuss in this line. But in terms of wrapping up the patience of our audience and the topics that we can handle for the time being, I wanted to close out by asking whether you've referenced so many books already. Are there particular reading materials that you would recommend to our audience at this time?
I would. Can I recommend three? Is that too many? I'll recommend three. So I just recently read the biography of Eunice Kennedy Shriver. She's the sister of President Kennedy, one of the siblings. She's the founder of Special Olympics, and she is the origin of almost all laws in the world that protect the intellectually disabled. And the biography has an intriguing title. It's called Eunice, the Kennedy Who Changed the World, by Eileen McNamara. I read it. I'm doing some projects with her son, Tim Shriver, and I thought I need to learn more about his family, his mother. And it is a great read. McNamara is a great journalist. And it's just inspiring to see what one person can do. Now, cynics will say, yeah, one person can do anything if your brother is president of the United States. But so that was a good start. But she did a lot more beyond that. So that's one that I would recommend. I'm a big fan of Yuval Levin. And a couple of years ago, he wrote a book called A Time to Build. It's a short book, a thin book, but it makes the great case that we conservatives need to be about building institutions, not tearing them down. And I think some of the discussions we had today are informed by that, to build the institution of the judiciary, not tear it down. And so much of the discussion today seeks to tear it down. So, I mean, I would recommend anything Yuval writes, any place, any time. But this book, A Time to Build, is particularly good. And then the last one is one that many of your listeners may not have heard of, but I love it. It's by a young scholar named Matthew Holland. I have some connection to him because he taught at Brigham Young University. And the book is called Bonds of Affection, Civic Charity, and the Making of America, published by Georgetown University Press. But Professor Holland takes us on an interesting journey, starting from the Massachusetts Bay Colony all the way up to Lincoln, to talk about this idea of bonds of affection and how central it has been to the American project. Now, it hasn't always succeeded, right? But it's always been there. And it's a strain of thought. It's part of our political DNA that's being neglected today. Now, Holland's a great writer. Once again, not a long book. It's a great read with a particularly interesting insight that I think is quite timely today. Those would be my three.
Those all sound very interesting. Eunice, A Time to Build, Bonds of Affection, three recommendations that'll be posted on our website for people to track down in further detail. Thank you, Judge Tom Griffith, for your reading suggestions and for your time and insights on Long Politics. Thanks also to our producer, Jody Mayer Piazza, and to our sponsor, the Holtzman Vogel Law Firm. Enjoy listening to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple, Google, or your favorite podcast streaming platform. Thanks for listening, everybody, and I hope you will join us again on the next episode of Early Returns.
Thanks for joining Early Returns, Law and Politics with Jan Behrend. We hope you will join us for future episodes, which will continue to bring you voices and insights from the people engaged in our political landscape.